Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Unlock big savings while adding style and security to your home with Schlage door locks from Menards. High-quality Schlage Wi-Fi compatible entry locks allow you to lock and unlock your home from anywhere with your phone. Get peace of mind and save big money on all door locks at Menards. Plus, don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
It's time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Welcome to another episode of Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky, and today we're going to be talking about narcolepsy. I have a guest who's joining us. His name is Matt Horsnell. He is a sleep ambassador. Welcome, Matt.
Yeah, thank you so much, Andrew. It's an honor to be here.
Great. We're happy to have you because we really want to cover this topic a lot. So a lot of questions to kind of get us started. I say that you're a sleep ambassador. Can you tell us what is that? What does a sleep ambassador do?
Yeah. So that's a great question. A sleep ambassador is it's an extension of the work I started in narcolepsy advocacy. When I first started sharing my voice about living with this condition, I was just talking about living with narcolepsy. And as my journey kind of evolved, I also got a diagnosis with obstructive sleep apnea. And that built also on a periodic limb movement disorder diagnosis. So I felt it was important to broadly talk about the work that I do is sleep. And so instead of just being a narcolepsy advocate or a narcolepsy ambassador, I decided to, with permission from Project Sleep, to anoint myself as a sleep ambassador of sorts. And then that represents the nonprofit advocacy work that I do. And then I also do consulting work for both sleep researchers, some physicians, and then also some partners in the pharmaceutical industry.
Wow. So you're all in on sleep, it sounds like.
Yes, sir.
You're talking about narcolepsy, and then you've got sleep apnea, and then you're talking about the periodic limb movement. So several things that we can kind of cover as we get into this. But let's start off with the question about narcolepsy in terms of what is narcolepsy?
Yeah, no, great question. So narcolepsy is a disorder of the sleep-wake system. It is recognized by kind of five hallmark symptoms, although there, as we'll talk a little bit later on, there's multiple symptoms that are also related that are outside that. The symptom that everyone with narcolepsy has is excessive daytime sleepiness. And now, when you say that, it's hard to capture the full weight of what that EDS is. But the language we will try to use is that it feels as if someone's been awake for 48 to 72 hours. That's how they start their day off. So as soon as my eyes wake up in the morning, there's a sleepiness that sits heavy throughout the day. There are periods of time when that sleepiness even becomes heavier, and that's when it gets to that like 72-hour mark. And that's some just profound sleepiness that can come with a lot of issues that you would associate with that. Four more symptoms that are also associated with type 1 narcolepsy, and so that's narcolepsy with cataplexy. That primary symptom there, NT1 or with cataplexy, cataplexy is an involuntary loss of muscle tone associated with an emotional response. So if you were to startle me, if I'm going to experience a moment of extreme elation, I can have a generalized cataplexy episode where I will completely fall. That's the sometimes you'll see a misportrayal in media where someone falls asleep when this is happening. But in reality, I'm actually fully aware of what's going on. So I can hear all the sounds. I can see people rushing over. I can hear the whispers that are happening. Now, that's an example of a full generalized episode. More common for me and more common for many people is a partial cataplexy. And so, again, partial meaning that it's going to take place in different parts of your body. So from like a head bob, if someone tells a funny joke, or I'll have a slack jaw, kind of a flat affect. I'll also have slurred speech. My knees will buckle. I'll also get really bad dropsies with the hands. And those are just examples of partial cataplexy that can hit. Again, typically associated with an overwhelming emotional response, but as I'm sleepier and as some of my medication has worn off, they can be more superficial. So later at night, I'm more likely to slur my speech than I am perhaps during the day. And a couple other symptoms that we talk about are hypnagogic and hypnopompic hallucinations. So those are visual, auditory, and tactile hallucinations associated with your transition from dream sleep to wakefulness, or wakefulness to dream sleep. And that's also coupled with sleep paralysis as well, which is that incomplete kind of transition out of sleep where your body is still paralyzed, but your mind turns on. And then the final symptom that is associated with narcolepsy and the hallmark symptoms is disrupted nighttime sleep. And I feel like that's one that it's easy for people to misconstrue that symptom early on as perhaps insomnia, because to be honest, I don't know if I could give you a straight answer of insomnia versus disrupted nighttime sleep. The two are very similar, but that disrupted nighttime sleep is what fuels the excessive daytime sleepiness for many people.
Wow. So there's a lot of pieces to this. So let me get some clarification on a couple things. So you were talking about cataplexy, where you may have partial or full. Is that how long does an episode normally last? If you lose that muscle, you know, tone.
Yeah. So speaking in it personally, and then also understanding kind of how it generally impacts people. So for me, cataplexy is fairly transient. You know, in terms of speech, it can be seconds. I've had a few full body episodes. The worst of them, and there's no best though. Let me just start by saying that. But the worst of them are typically going to be about 15 to 30 seconds. However, it feels much longer because again, you're trapped within your body. There is a very rare subset of cataplexy called status cataplecticus, which is recurrent bouts of cataplexy that can take place throughout the day. It's not necessarily just one single cataplexy. It's a kind of an ongoing issue. And again, those are more profound examples as well. Generally speaking, it would not be common to see a cataplexy episode last more than probably 60 seconds. But that's, again, you know, I'm sure there are some people who are experiencing some of the longer end of those.
So then am I correct that if we're talking about maybe a pretty serious case, that somebody with narcolepsy could have an episode of cataplexy, and it sounds like it could be kind of dangerous. You could fall and hit your head or something, right? Because you're not in control of your muscle tone.
Yeah. And I think even not even considering the worst of the cases, any kind of like a startled response, if I buckle, you know, my risk of injury is somewhat low in terms of I'm not going to try to brace myself. And so you've got this kind of loose approach. It's not any rigidity, but the risk for a head injury is very real. If you fall in the wrong spot, you're going to potentially open yourself up to a concussion, and it can obviously get bad from there. My worst injury was I broke my leg in three places as I fell down some steps, and it was my body weight collapsed on top of my leg. That was about 6 weeks after my narcolepsy diagnosis, and first thing out of my doctor's mouth was, should we do a med adjustment here? Does this happen frequently? Fortunately, I've not had anything that severe since then, but it can happen.
Wow, that's really hard. So, is there any like warning that you have that you might be having a cataplectic episode?
Some people have expressed that they feel almost a tinge of, you know, perhaps muscle tingling. For me, it's more or less the emotional weight. So if I'm in a situation, you know, oftentimes you'll hear about laughter being a key trigger, but it can be any emotion. So confrontation is one that I deal with as well. So if I'm confronted or if I'm in a heated exchange, I can start to feel my body getting slightly overwhelmed. And I usually will excuse myself mm-hmm. from that situation to mitigate any potential cataplexy. I also don't go to comedy clubs because the last time I did, my belly hurt so much from laughing and I was just slumped over against the wall the entire time, really not able to fully enjoy the experience. So I think, you know, again, right. If I know that the emotions are going to be heavy, I try to make sure that I've got a chair by myself near me, or that I'm in a position where I'm comfortable in case something like that is going to happen.
Right, right. Wow. Okay. So then tell us, in terms of narcolepsy coming on, is there a particular age that it normally comes on? Does it affect men or women differently? Can you give us a little bit more detail about that?
Yeah, so great question. So there is a bimodal distribution in terms of the age of onset, but the largest peak of onset is in the late teens, early 20s. So you see the largest spike mm-hmm. of cases. Unfortunately, there's about an 8 to 15 year time to diagnosis. So that symptom onset to getting the official narcolepsy diagnosis. For me, that was 13 years, age of onset about 12,
wow.
diagnosis age 25. The prevalence rate varies. Looking at different statistics, about 1 in 2,000 is the general prevalence rate that we see quoted. Again, that's cases, that's not necessarily diagnosed cases. And then in terms of, gender differences or sex differences, rather, it's about 50-50 in terms of who it impacts. When I mentioned the bimodal distribution, there's another slight bump at about late 30s, early 40s that you'll also see.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So if it took, you know, even in your own case, if you say it kind of came on around 12, but it took, you know, many years for you to be diagnosed, what, you know, I can only imagine, you know, a kid in junior high school, tired, you know, probably your parents are thinking, well, he's just exhausted. He's doing a lot of stuff. He's not getting good sleep and he's probably tired. So what are some of the biggest misconceptions that people may have before they realize that they actually have a diagnosis of narcolepsy?
Another great question. For me, I started presenting at about age 13 or 14 to my pediatrician, talking about how I'm very mm-hmm. sleepy. One of the challenges is, you know, when I say sleepy, I may also use the term fatigue interchangeably. I've learned not to use that as I've become more involved with communicating about this condition. But sometimes those are used interchangeably, and that can lead the doctor down one path or another. Depression was what the physician first said. It was, you're sleepy because you're depressed. And it took me forever to realize that, no, I'm depressed because I'm sleepy. And I feel like when I was able to kind of make that paradigm shift, you know, again, it's just one end of the same rope. Like, it's hard to fully tease that out. After the depression diagnosis, you know, we tried, you know, a handful of different antidepressants and then jumped into attention deficit as well. And again, I was probably inattentive because I was sleepy. And then I took it upon myself at age 25 to go ahead and get an appointment with a sleep physician, and thinking I had sleep apnea at the time. And at that time, I didn't have sleep apnea, but it was a pretty clear-cut case. And I even left that mm-hmm. consult. And my sleep physician said, you know, hey, Matt, we have to go through the PSG, polysomnography, and an MSLT. He explained those. He said, if we didn't have those tools, I would be giving you a diagnosis of narcolepsy. We have to see where it goes, but this is what I'm thinking. And that was the first time I had heard my name associated with that term.
Wow. Okay. Well, let me stop us for a commercial break here because this is a good stopping point. So this is Sleep Science Today. We're talking with Matt Horsnell about narcolepsy. We'll be back in just a minute.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
The station that makes you feel good.
All right, welcome back. This is your host, Andrew Kolsky, Sleep Science Today. We're talking with Matt Horsnell, and we were just talking about the diagnosis of narcolepsy. So to follow up, I had a question for you, which is, you know, again, I'm assuming your parents and your doctors, nobody initially realized it was narcolepsy. Did you end up in any sort of situations where you were being punished, or did your teachers not understand the situation? You know, what are some of the real life consequences that someone who's, you know, early 20s, pre-20s might deal with in this situation?
Yeah, so the biggest impact was socially. The weight of this condition decreased my desire to go out and spend time with friends. In college in particular, I would deal with a lot of teasing. You know, no one wants to have a roommate that sleeps all the time. And so the reality is, you know, it was challenging for me to get out and relate and connect. There's a lot of negative self-talk that also is associated with this condition. You know, you have, you know, 100 voices echoing, you know, get up, push through, you know, this is, you know, some kind of moral failing. And again, one of the main reasons I decided to share was that, you know, I wanted to make sure that people knew that sleepiness is not laziness, and that this is not a moral failing of myself, that this is actually a neurological condition. But I think, again, academics, I didn't thrive where I probably would have. I was a straight B student through high school, but basically I was sleeping, you know, 2 or 3 classes a day. It wasn't until college that I started to get my footing in terms of learning how to strategically nap in order to put myself in a position to succeed. But there's definitely academic considerations that people experience, social challenges, you know, and then again, you open up your risk for ridicule if you're falling asleep in class. You know, you get that moniker, the sleepy kid. And again, I didn't know I was any different. Other people were sleeping in class, but I didn't realize that they weren't going to bed at 8 o'clock on a given night. So it was hard for me to fully appreciate how different I was.
Right. Wow. Okay, so you told us that at some point you finally went and you got some sleep tests to start figuring out what was going on. So let's assume we're at that stage where somebody is starting to kind of question for themselves whether something might be going on here that needs to be looked at. What types of things can be done to, you know, recognize narcolepsy, diagnose narcolepsy, treat narcolepsy? Give us some background on what people can actually do about it.
Yeah. So one of the challenges that I've learned the more I've gotten involved in public speaking and advocacy is that physicians by and large are only getting anywhere between, you know, 15 minutes to maybe 2 hours of training on sleep as a whole. You know, when you approach your physician's office, if they're not a specialist, they may only be able to speak in terms of generalities about sleep, you know, identify, oh, you may need to make sure you're putting your phone away and make sure that you're getting consistent sleep. All great suggestions. But when you're dealing with a neurological disorder, it's that you can't adapt your way out of the condition. So I think right. If you're in a position where you're looking for an answer, you think, hey, I'm sleeping, you know, 12 hours on a given day, or, you know, I'm sleeping the normal amount of time, you know, 9 hours, but I'm still having to take multiple naps throughout the day. You know, I would reach out and start looking for social support early on. I can't tell you how helpful that was to coach me on how to talk and advocate for myself. And then don't hesitate, you know, pushing back if you aren't feeling that you're being heard. Again, when you speak with your physician, talk about how impactful the sleep is. If I say I'm sleepy, that's one thing. But if I say I'm unable to do X, Y, and Z because I'm sleepy, you know, I'm concerned about potentially sleepy driving, drowsy driving issues. Well, then all of a sudden you're going to get your doctor's attention a little bit, because they realize if they don't take an action step, that could be problematic for both the patient, but also the physician. And so really press upon the physician the importance of why this is impacting you, how this is impacting you. And that really kind of both grounds the conversation in like situations. It's not speaking in generalities. And I think that would be my first step, is make sure that you're really going to the physician and ask for a specialist. You know, if you're talking to your general practitioner, internal medicine physician, make sure you're saying, hey, can we get a referral for this? Because I think it may be something a little bit more serious. It's not just I'm struggling to stay awake. It's that it's a profound, overwhelming issue here.
Right, right. So when you finally got to that stage personally that you realized you wanted to see a specialist to really kind of get a better handle on this, what types of things did a specialist do to confirm whether you did or did not have narcolepsy?
Yeah. So my physician did a great job. He provided me with a very thorough questionnaire. That questionnaire looked a lot about things that I didn't necessarily appreciate were related to my sleep issues. There was a lot of questions about falls. There was a lot of questions about, do you define yourself as clumsy? And I remember reading through this, being a little bit miffed as to what this had to do with my sleep issue. You know, I'm here to possibly get a CPAP and just get out the door. I didn't realize that all the nuances that were involved there. So we used a very thorough screening process. I was very fortunate to have a physician who stopped and took some serious time to talk through this issue with me. Coincidentally, there was a fellow who was working on his rotation, and he actually called in this physician to come listen to my story. He said, "I think I need you to hear what this young man is saying, and then we'll talk out of the room and come back, and we'll see what next steps we're going to take." And again, the questions were a lot about, you know, the clumsiness issue, or, you know, any kind of falls, or do I slump over at all? So again, it was. He asked a lot of questions to really understand the condition better, or my symptoms better. How disabling were the sleep disorder symptoms? How many times was I napping? And really tried to get a full picture. And from there, you know, it was, you know, I checked all the boxes for a need. There's a test called the Epworth Sleepiness Scale that if you go to a sleep physician, you'll be intimately aware of, that looks at situational sleepiness. I could have a whole episode about why, you know, that may be an imperfect tool. There's also a tool called the Narcolepsy Severity Scale that actually looks at all five of those hallmark symptoms that is made by Yves Davier over in Europe, and it has great application in terms of understanding the full weight of the sleepiness. So those are some tools that you expect to see before you get into the overnight test. And then you have the multiple sleep latency test for confirmation.
Yeah, that's actually what I was going to ask about next. So you fill out this questionnaire, you get all this background work done, but eventually you end up going into a sleep lab overnight. Is that right?
Yeah, so it's done differently in Europe than it is in the U.S. There's in Europe, they will actually there's a genetic test that you can take to see if you have the gene that predisposes someone to narcolepsy type 1, and that's an HLA-DQB1 gene. If you test positive for that gene, and about 95 to 99% of people with type 1 narcolepsy have the gene. Unfortunately, about 25% of the population also has the gene, so it's not a direct association, but it's a strong indicator. They can also do a spinal tap. Over in Europe, it's fairly common, and they're checking for orexin levels in your CSF, and that actually is the neurotransmitter that has been found to be lacking. Orexin also goes by the name hypocretin. So if it's less than 110 picograms per milliliter, that's confirmation that someone has NT1. In the United States, we focus on the NSLT. So after they've ruled out potential sleep apnea, you will have the next day, which is a multiple sleep latency test, which is a series of five naps spaced out about every 2 hours. And these naps are about 15 minutes. And what they're trying to do is make sure that you have a combined or averaged time to nap underneath 8 minutes, I believe is what the timing is the average. And then they're also checking to see if you go into REM sleep. So they want to make sure that if you go into REM sleep in two of these naps, that's a confirmation as well. The reliability of the MSLT is somewhat in question for people with type 2 narcolepsy. That's without cataplexy and IH. However, with type 1 narcolepsy, it's supposed to be about 85% able to be replicated each time. But again, you're in a clinical environment, it may not promote sleepiness like you may have in an at-home environment. But it's the tool that we have, and so we certainly lean heavily on it.
Right. So I want to clarify something for the audience. So you talked a lot about type 1 narcolepsy. Is there a type 2 or type 3 or type 4?
Great follow-up question. So type 2 narcolepsy is narcolepsy without cataplexy. So you have all of those major hallmark symptoms. So it's a tetrad as opposed to the pentad. So you have everything except for the cataplexy. Statistics vary if you look at insurance databases versus some of the research. It's usually believed to be about 75% of people with narcolepsy have type 1 narcolepsy. And one of the challenges with that is cataplexy is also a self-reported symptom. It's fairly challenging to provoke a cataplexy attack, in a laboratory setting. If a physician doesn't see it and you are not talking about, slurred speech or falls, they may not pick up on that cataplexy piece. So there's also sometimes a progression aspect. Someone may present with type 2 early on and later realize that they have cataplexy a little bit later on and have a change in diagnosis. There is a sister condition, if you will, called idiopathic hypersomnia, which, as the name implies, it means you're really sleepy and we don't know why. And it also will test positive on the multiple sleep latency test. However, it will not show REM intrusion into your naps. So very similar condition that actually, in terms of the sleepiness, the symptoms do vary. There's a lot of nuances there. But that can also be associated with long sleep time. So 11 plus hours of sleep per night, or what they call a normal sleep subtype, which is, again, 7 to 9 hours asleep as well. People with narcolepsy, especially when treated, generally have about the same volume of sleep as someone without narcolepsy. So it's the quality of sleep at night is so poor, and then the sleepiness throughout the day is really what stands out.
Okay. So we get to the point where we do the tests that you were describing. We find out that, yes, there is a diagnosis of narcolepsy, let's say type 1. So now there's no question this patient has narcolepsy. What do we do about it?
Fantastic question. the reality is most of the time you're given a prescription pad, and you're given pretty much a wakefulness promoter to kickstart. And it, again, to help address the daytime sleepiness. Unfortunately, all too often, that's all that's really given. You're told to come back for a follow-up appointment to discuss if your symptoms get worse. You're usually advised to avoid drowsy driving, which, again, I think should be advice given to anybody. But the physician, of course, will lean heavily on that as well. And then, you know, you're off to come back for your follow-up. The reality is it does need to be a much more comprehensive, you know, approach to treating this condition. And, you know, I definitely would be love to share that with you kind of in detail as well coming up here.
Yeah. So this is a perfect spot for our next commercial break. And then when we come back, let's follow up right from where we're leaving off. So we're going to break the commercial. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Okay, we're back with Sleep Science Today. We're talking narcolepsy. And Matt, you were just about to tell us more about treatment, so please continue.
Yeah, so, you know, treatment can look different ways. You know, typically when it comes to treating a neurological condition, you know, medication is that, you know, this is the standard you have to take. And with narcolepsy, that's also the case. There's a couple of different medication interventions that can be taken. There's the wakefulness promoters, which can include traditional stimulants and some newer medication that don't quite pass the stimulant diagnosis or like litmus test, but they still promote wakefulness. Mm-hmm. There's a new generation of histamine inverse agonist, which promote wakefulness through the histamine pathway. And then there's also some nighttime sleep aids, called sodium oxybate, that are explicitly used for narcolepsy type 1 and type 2, and then IH. So that addresses the nighttime piece. You promote, you know, a good night's sleep, or, you know, good night's sleep, air quotations, a better quality sleep, a more sustained sleep without the disruptions. And then they also will use antidepressants to help reduce or lower the cataplexy threshold, and to help people adapt in that way. And then again, I think for a little bit later on, we can talk about the investigational approaches with orexin receptor agonists, which I think could be transformative in terms of how we treat the condition medically. Now, that's the medical piece, right. But I think the piece that gets missed a lot are that you want to use kind of a four-pronged approach. It's like four legs on a table. If you've got one leg that's out of balance with the other, you know, your table is going to be wobbly. And that's the same thing with wakefulness and living with narcolepsy. So naps, for me, is a huge part of living my best life with narcolepsy. I call them both strategic naps and recovery naps. So I try to keep a similar schedule throughout the day, and then I have select time for napping, usually within an hour window. I can time it with medications oftentimes, but it just kind of helps dust. I call it a little rim rescue, you know, jump in, perhaps get some dream sleep, hop out on the go throughout the day. My nap time is anywhere between 15 minutes to 25 minutes is my sweet spot. Then again, if I have to struggle to take a rescue nap, I'm willing to do that as well. It's the naps in the wild, if you will. And the other two approaches, I think equally as important for your table, is you have lifestyle adjustments. So again, that's I've never really appreciated the term sleep hygiene because my sleep isn't dirty. It's just really poor quality. The message behind sleep hygiene or sleep health, I think, is so important for us. Making sure that you have routine and structure and consistency, making sure that your bedroom, you know, is designed for sleep and sex kind of as the two standalones. You're not sitting in bed, you know, doomsday scrolling on your phone or watching television. For me, that also includes physical activity. It can be a very big challenge for me to motivate myself to go work out. But the long-term benefits later on that day and throughout the week are big. Narcolepsy in particular is associated with a higher BMI. And while I hate that measurement for the sake of the conversation, you know, it's important to note that we do have extra body weight oftentimes because of that sedentary aspect of narcolepsy. Mm. So making sure that you're being physical active. Also associated with it is, some dietary components. So making sure that you're not just basically drinking sugary drinks all the time, because again, you've got the what goes up must come down approach with sugar. Although I will say that most PWN or people with narcolepsy do like to keep a little sugar stash to kind of help through some of the tough times. I think the piece that has been so impactful for me is a behavioral intervention or social support. So I use those terms to consolidate kind of under one table leg. So talking with a therapist. I actually have a counseling appointment later today. I keep an appointment once every 2 to 3 weeks to just talk through what it's like to live with this condition. There's some great work, CBTH or CBT for hypersomnolence. There's also some mindfulness efforts that are underway, better understand how to live with this condition. Acceptance and commitment therapy has been a great tool for a lot of people. And then the piece that I think gave me so much joy early on and still does is small groups. So connecting with people who live with narcolepsy is like a salve for my soul. It helps me realize that I'm not alone. It helps me give back. I can share the successes. I can share the misses on how I've lived with this condition. And again, if my voice can give anyone a sense of comfort or potentially reduce the time to diagnosis or help someone better appreciate what it's like to live a quality life with this condition, it makes those struggles worthwhile. And that's where I think social support can play an integral part. So again, you've got your medication treatments, your naps, your behavioral and social support, and then your lifestyle adjustments. And that's the best way to have your narcolepsy or sleep disorder table balanced.
Right. Wow. That's great information for anyone who's dealing with that. So I want to get into a couple other things. We've got about 6 minutes left in our show, so I want to make sure we have time to get into this. Can you give us the benefit of your knowledge about, number one, what's in the works, what's coming down the pike in terms of treatment, and number two, about resources that might be available to people if they do need resources and help?
Yeah, so I think the community is really excited about the orexin receptor agonists that are coming to potentially, they're in clinical trials right now. There's one that's in a phase 3 trial. There's a total of 8 companies looking to develop an orexin receptor agonist. That much money coming in, you know, it gives everybody a good appreciation that it should get across the finish line. The early results from some of these trials have shown perhaps a 3 times greater increase of treatment than any single monotherapy has been around. So we're talking like a reduction of Epworth 3 times greater than what's currently on the market today. So far, we don't know what that looks like in terms of how it impacts nighttime sleep, but we do know for daytime wakefulness issues, it will reduce your Epworth to actually sometimes below the normal. So you'll have an Epworth anywhere between, you know, underneath 7. The average is 3 to 7, even for people without a sleep disorder. So transformative in terms of how it could potentially impact how we live with this condition. And so very excited about that.
Wow.
To answer the other question there in terms of resources, I always like to say, if you think you have a sleep disorder, reach out both to your physician, make sure that you're asking your physician for these appointments. A tremendous resource is actually Project Sleep's Sleep Helpline. It's open throughout the day. You can reach out by web form, by email, by a phone call, and you get to connect with someone who is a trained sleep specialist that will help you connect with resources. It's not providing care, but it is providing you connections to care. So if you're looking for a list of physicians, if you're looking for, you know, a therapist in your area, if you're looking for groups, it basically combines the collective resources of Project Sleep and helps you get those answers. That also applies for any of the sleep disorders as well.
Well, let me ask you about the Project Sleep. Is there a website for Project Sleep?
Yeah, so project-sleep.org is their website, and that would be kind of your one-stop shop to send you around to the different resources. Wakeupnarcolepsy.org also is a great resource for those online support groups. Those are the groups that provided me with such invaluable care. I facilitated those groups for 5 years, and again, I've made some huge friendships through there. So that would be another resource that I would look at. And the helpline is available through Project Sleep's website as well.
Okay. Now you and I are both in the U.S. Are those resources available to people only in the U.S. or also outside of the U.S.?
Yeah. No, thank you for asking. I think that the resources through Project Sleep are U.S. focused. However, there is some that have universal applications. So there's guides on how to talk to your physician. There's guides on how to live with this condition a little bit easier. But if you're looking for resources in Europe, I know there's a Narcolepsy UK nonprofit, and then there's also European Narcolepsy Alliance for Patients. ENAP is their acronym. That's a great resource for the European Union in terms of trying to find resources and connect to care. The resources available are fairly similar across the pond and over here, but there's of course different ways that you have to approach that with the different healthcare systems that they have over in Europe, and then obviously with the physicians that are available over there. Although I will say some of the best physicians to treat this condition, I do know are practicing over in Europe right now, and just phenomenal minds across the globe really coming together to help elevate our understanding and approach to treating this condition.
Fantastic. Thank you for that. So we've got just a little over a minute, and I do want to get an opportunity for you to at least share with us. I know you recently went to the White House in the U.S. to talk about sleep health equity. Can you give us just a quick snippet on that?
Yeah, I'll give you the quick version here. So this past November, we had a chance to go to the White House and meet with representatives across multiple executive organizations. And we talked about sleep health equity, the challenges of accessing care provided an unbalanced burden on certain populations in the U.S. And so I was honored to speak from a place of the challenges that I had seen from a socioeconomic perspective, difficulty obtaining the care, transportation to appointments, and it was great to feel heard. You know, I love legislative advocacy, and this was a way to take that conversation to the next level and get into the executive branch. And you know, we had a warm welcome, and I thought it was a great conversation. It wasn't just myself; it was multiple leading experts as well. A nice little round table of sleep brilliance, if you will.
Right. Wow. Well, I mean, it's nice that there's obviously attention being paid to these types of issues. And like you shared, and I wish we had time to get into all of it, we don't. But, you know, we've just talked about narcolepsy, but you alluded to the sleep apnea element and so many other sleep disorders that are out there and probably not known well by many doctors because they just don't have the training in school. It's not that they're bad doctors. They just aren't exposed to it, so they can't know what they don't know.
Exactly.
But we're out of time for today. So this is Andrew Kolsky with Sleep Science Today. I want to thank you all for joining us and learning about different sleep issues. Please feel free to check out other episodes and check out our website at sleepsciencetoday.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter and special information. We also can check out our YouTube channel and actually see the conversation as opposed to just hearing it. So, Matt, thank you for your time. I appreciate you joining us, and I wish you the best.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Thank you
for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, sleep science today and sleep better tonight.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.